After listening to this segment of Please Explain, you may never casually squash a spider again. Spiders, it turns out, are unbelievably complex and interesting creatures, and they deserve our attention and respect in many cases. Joining us to explain why are Dr. Norm Platnick, the Curator Emeritus in the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Invertebrate Zoology, and the curator of the museum's new exhibition called Spiders Alive. Also, Hazel Davis, she is the Associate Director of Living Exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History. Welcome to our show.
Hello. Great to be here.
Norm, should we assume that there are spiders living here in the offices and studios of WNYC?
Oh, absolutely. Spiders are in most buildings. They're probably not very far from you, actually.
Can they hear the show? Are they able to hear?
Well, spiders live in a world that is largely sensed by vibration. I wouldn't call it hearing per se, but they have hairs that are incredibly sensitive. So even the slightest vibration, either in the air or in the substrate, they can detect and respond to.
Although unlike insects, they don't have antennae.
No, they don't have antennae, and their eyes are simple rather than the complex eyes that you'd find in a housefly, for example. So most spiders do not have great vision, and they sense the world primarily through vibration.
Hazel, I read an article in the New York Times that described you as putting the spiders in your exhibit through spider obedience school, which implies that they can learn. Is that an exaggeration?
Not exactly. They can learn. They do have a capacity for memory. And what we did was we wanted to get them ready for the presentation area that we have in the exhibit, which is it's a new thing for an exhibit at the museum, and it's where people can see a person with a live spider, and we have a camera there, and you can see the spider magnified on the screen. And we wanted to get the spiders ready because, as Norm mentioned, they do sense the world around them through vibration. And so to do that, to get them ready, we spent a lot of time first touching them gently, getting them ready to vibrations in the air from our voices, and just so that they would begin to associate that feeling with the fact that they were still safe. They weren't under attack.
And they're going to be passed by thousands of people every day, so they have to get used to that as well.
They do. Yes, there's a lot of noise in the gallery, so there's a lot of sound vibrations from that. So that the spiders don't get stressed out in the presentation area, we do actually have 17 individual spiders, and they only work one day, and then they rest until it's their turn again in the rotation. So that's to help make sure that they're not constantly bombarded with this sort of stimulus.
Norm, what kind of nervous system do they have? Do they have something we might think of as a brain?
Indeed. They have the equivalent of a brain and a peripheral nervous system. And what's interesting is, of course, many spiders are quite small. And when they get quite small, the percentage of their total body mass that's devoted to the nervous system, and particularly the brain, remains pretty high. And in the smallest spiders, it even extends out into the legs a little.
Well, how are they classified or defined? What are their closest relatives in the animal kingdom?
Well, spiders are arachnids, along with other groups like scorpions and whip scorpions that we have examples of in the exhibition as well. All arachnids have eight legs. Insects have only six. And spiders have two main body parts, a head and an abdomen. Insects have three main body parts, so they're actually very different. But
so they're not related, really? One doesn't come from the other?
In the sense that they are, insects and arachnids are both members of the phylum arthropods, which also includes crustaceans and millipedes, for example. So it's a huge group, the largest phylum.
So they're related to lobsters and crabs?
Absolutely, absolutely. All these animals have an exoskeleton, and they can only grow by shedding that exoskeleton, by molting.
And I understand that there are an incredible number of different kinds of spiders out there. 40,000 different kinds?
Absolutely. Scientists have already distinguished over 43,000 different kinds of spiders, different species, and even our rosiest estimates suggest that we're only halfway there, that there are at least another 40 or 50,000 species that have not yet been described. So we really know very little about this planet. What it comes down to.
In every continent except Antarctica.
Right.
I imagine Antarctica either. They just never got there. It was too cold for them.
Well, there are spiders in the Arctic, but they have not been found in the Antarctic.
Do all of them spin webs, Hazel?
Well, all spiders have spinnerets and silk glands, and they use silk for some things, but only about half the species of spiders in the world build a web to catch their prey. Other spiders are hunting spiders. They will actively hunt their spiders. They don't rely on a web to catch the prey, but they still use silk for other things, like constructing an egg case around their eggs.
And then we have the silk that becomes the silk. So is that just a special kind of silk?
Well, an individual spider can have as many as 7 different kinds of silk glands in its abdomen, and each kind of gland produces silk with different physical properties that's used for different things. So some silks, for example, are used for drag lines, and when the spider moves around every few inches, it will attach a strand of silk to the ground, and if it happens to fall, then it can climb back up that drag line.
How long, Hazel, have spiders existed? Did they live in the time? Oh, let me ask Norm that. Did they live in the time of the dinosaurs?
Absolutely. Spiders are among the very first creatures on land to emerge from the sea. They weren't the first, obviously, because they're predators. There had to be insects for them to eat. But they're very, very early. And some arachnid relatives, like scorpions, are among the very earliest land creatures.
My guests are Dr. Norm Plotnick, the curator emeritus in the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Invertebrate Zoology, and Hazel Davis, the Associate Director of Living Exhibits at the museum. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about spiders on today's Please Explain It, and we invite your calls with any questions you might have. 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Hazel, you brought some spiders, a spider with you. Is that a large one that I'm seeing here, or is it just my eyesight is bad?
I brought 2 different species with me. These are actually molts when the spider has grown. Because they're arthropods, they have to molt their exoskeleton in order to get bigger. So they form a new skeleton underneath, and when they're ready, they get out of this old exoskeleton. Basically, they pull out their legs very carefully, and they leave an entire sort of shed skin behind. It includes everything you can see here, even the fangs.
And what happens to that skeleton? It just sits there?
It just sits there. It dries, and they basically leave it behind. This was actually molted by our Mexican Redney 2 weeks ago. He molted on exhibit, and we left the skeleton, the molted skin there for people to see for a while, but he got kind of fed up with having it there, and he actually picked it up and he moved it next to the door for us to take it out.
Within the exhibit, how many kinds of spiders are represented?
We have 16 species of spiders. We have 4 other arachnid species in the exhibit. We wanted to show as much diversity as we could.
Did they get along with each other?
Well, they're all housed separately in separate habitats.
Would they kill each other if they weren't?
There are species that do that are social. There are social spiders, and we have some movie footage of that. Predominantly, though, the spiders, because they're sort of opportunistic feeders, they will feed on other spiders, so it's not a good idea to have them housed together, most of them.
So some of them are omnivores, some are just herbivores, aren't they?
Probably ask Norm, though. I think there is
no,
a species.
No, they're all predators.
They're all predators.
Yeah. They have fangs.
There are a few that, for example, will consume pollen that sticks to the webs, and when the spiders often recycle the silk in their webs, they eat the silk in order to reuse the proteins, and so they will get some energy from the pollen. But by and large, they're predators, and then they like to hunt live food. They're not even scavengers of dead food.
And they use their fangs the way we might use teeth?
In a sense, the fangs are used to inject venom, and that venom obviously has evolved over many millions of years to paralyze insects, and it's very effective in doing that. But they don't actually eat through the fangs. The mouth is to the back, and the way spiders actually eat only liquid food. So once they've caught the prey and paralyzed it, they secrete and spit into the insect enzymes that dissolve the internal structures of the insect, which they then suck back up as a liquid.
A friend had to go to the doctor recently because she'd been bitten by a spider. They had to give her antibiotics. Is that common? Why would a spider want to bite a human?
It's actually very rare, and many of the things that people suspect as being spider bites, and physicians even diagnose as being spider bites, actually are not. Most spiders in general want to be as far away as they can from anything as loud and huge as a human. Their instinct is to simply go the other direction. Probably half the spiders on the planet are so small that even if they tried to bite you, they couldn't break through your skin. If a spider does bite you and breaks through your skin, in almost all cases, the venom will have absolutely no effect because it's evolved to work on insects. And if it has an effect on humans or other vertebrates, that's just an accident of chemistry. So there are actually very few spiders, even though almost all spiders have venom, there are very few that have venom that's dangerous to humans.
We want to take some calls, and our first caller is Dom from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
I just have a quick story. I used to work in Fort Lee, and we were unpacking eggs that came from the south. And in the box of eggs was a spider the size of a dumpling with legs as big as thick pencils. And rather than kill it, because it's actually too big to step on, we called the Museum of Natural History, and somebody, I guess it was a local guy from the museum that lived in Fort Lee, came and got it. And then we got a certificate that said it was a thing called a diving spider, and it caught fish. But I never really followed up on it. And now that I heard your show, I'm just wondering, am I misremembering this, or is that something that actually could happen?
Well, it sounds like a fishing spider, and we actually have one member of that family in the exhibition. They're typically found.
Maybe it's Dom's spider. But I didn't think spiders went into water.
Well, there's actually one spider in Eurasia that lives in fresh water, and it's very, very unusual. But fishing spiders are always found near the water, and they will sit with their legs spread out on the surface of the water so that they can feel vibrations. And if an insect lands on the surface of the water, they'll catch it, and they can even sense a small fish that swims underneath, and they can grab it.
Now, you said that they are unlikely to bite us, but you mentioned earlier that there are scorpions, there are tarantulas. They're not spiders?
Scorpions are not spiders, no. They're a different group of arachnids. Tarantulas are spiders.
Well, why do they bite people?
They don't normally. I mean, we have this image, you know, from James Bond movies of, you know, the poor man being in dire peril because a tarantula is walking across his chest, and the only thing he's in danger of is itching a little because they have urticating hairs as one of their defense mechanisms. But even if a tarantula were to bite you, as in almost all other spiders, the venom would have no effect.
Let's go to another call. Michael from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you? I'm in the suburbs of New Jersey, so I'm in a lot of, wooded areas and stuff. And I see a lot of spiders, like big, big webs and stuff, but there'll be a tree maybe about 10 to 15 feet away from it with a thin web just going right across from there, like continuous. Like, how do they get across and keep it up in the air?
Well, most likely what you're finding is the first line, what's called the bridge line that an orb web is constructed with. And basically the spider has to let a strand of silk out from its spinnerets and let it get caught by the wind and carried over to someplace else, and then it can walk across that bridge line. So that's actually the toughest part of getting a large web established. Depending on the environment, it might be able to walk up and across and back down, but in many cases it relies on the wind.
The same way that Spider-Man moves from building to building.
Not exactly.
We have to take a little break. We invite your calls, 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we also have a slideshow of spiders from the American Museum of Natural History Spiders Alive exhibit on that show page at WNYC.org. Stay with us. We are back with Please Explain, a look at spiders with Dr. Norm Plotnick, the Curator Emeritus at the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Invertebrate Zoology, and Hazel Davis, Associate Director of Living Exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History. There is an exhibit about spiders currently at the museum called Spiders Alive. And Hazel, what's the most challenging part about putting together a live exhibit of spiders on this scale. Do you ever get any escapees?
Not so far. We've been pretty lucky with that. I guess one of the challenges is we didn't want to... we wanted to show as much diversity with the species as possible. So we didn't want to just have tarantulas, which people are quite familiar with. So that's a problem in that some of the species that we have are quite seasonal. They only live really for one summer, and then they die. So having spiders for that sort of short length of time is quite difficult.
So they live for one summer, and then what happens? Do they lay eggs that then come back the next summer?
Exactly, yes.
They sit all that time through the winter?
Yes, they do. So the spiders basically grow and live through the summer season and then into the fall, and then they tend to, especially here, they tend to die out with the first frosts. But we do have a big diversity of spiders. So some of them, the tarantulas that we have, can live quite a long time in captivity, some of them even over 20 years. So sort of the challenge is finding the different species that we wanted to exhibit and actually being able to acquire those spiders. Some of them come from breeders. Some of them have been sent to us by colleagues around the world.
Do people collect spiders as pets?
People do keep spiders as pets.
In Asia mostly, I imagine.
All over. I mean, spiders are... tarantulas are very big in the hobby in the U.S., so there are a lot of people in the U.S. that keep different species of tarantulas. But other people quite often will keep them seasonally. You know, they'll find one in their garden and keep it and enjoy it.
Norm, I understand that the goblin spider is an area of specialty for you. What kind of research are you doing?
Well, I'm a taxonomist, so my research concentrates on distinguishing the species and learning how they're related to each other and thereby how they've evolved. And we picked the group of goblin spiders because it was basically the most poorly known group of spiders on the planet, and that's mostly because they're very, very small. Most of them are under 2 millimeters in total length, which means you could put half a dozen of them on the tip of an eraser of a pencil. And that makes them difficult to study. But with new imaging techniques, and especially things like scanning electron microscopy, we can find out a lot about them, and they turn out to be extraordinarily interesting. They just do things differently than typical spiders in many cases.
A caller asks, is it good to have spiders in your house? Are they eating other bugs?
Absolutely. I mean, just as people now are realizing that, yes, bees can sting you, but bees are enormously important because without bees, most of our crops don't get pollinated and we starve. And the same thing is true of spiders. Even though spiders are not so much a danger from biting, the fact is they are the primary predators of insects. And without spiders here, insect populations would increase dramatically and all our crops would be eaten by insects.
So the presence of spiders might suggest you have an insect infestation problem. We could only hope that they eat bed bugs.
Well, the interesting thing is probably one of the most common spiders in New York City apartments is an introduced species. It isn't native to New York at all. And the most common food that those spiders eat is a cockroach species that is also introduced and not native to New York.
Do spiders, John asks, have any complex social behaviors like ants?
They do. There are a handful of species that are social, by which that means they live on a communal web and they will cooperate in catching prey that's too big for any one of them to catch by themselves. But that's very much the exception. Most species are solitary and they're generalist feeders, so they will eat anything they can manage to catch, and that includes other spiders and even other spiders of the same species. So males, for example, when they're searching for females in order to mate, their biggest problem is to find a way to communicate to the female that they are a potential mate and not just food.
Is it easy to spot a male?
It is, actually. Spiders have 8 legs, obviously, but in front of the front pair of legs, there's another pair of appendages that look a little like short legs. They're the pedipalps, actually. And in females, they are very leg-like. But in males, adult males, the last segment has become very much enlarged and very complex in morphology because those are the structures that are actually used to transfer sperm to the females during mating.
Christine from New Jersey is on the air. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, my question is about brown root spider. I know that you mentioned that a lot of spiders are not venomous, but I've seen online pictures of people with, like, big holes in their arms or thighs from a bite of brown root spider.
Yes.
How can I identify them? And,
okay.
You know, why? What about those type of spiders? Why do they get such a big bite?
Okay. Actually, there are only two kinds of spiders in the U.S. that people have to worry about in terms of venom that's dangerous to people, and the brown recluse is one of them. And those are very easy to recognize because on the head, they have a dark marking that looks like a violin. With the broad part of the violin up at the very front. And so it's a very distinctive marking and very easy to see. And
how big are they?
They're about half an inch to three quarters of an inch when they're adult. They're not things that you're likely to see in this area. They're not native to the Northeast. They're a southern and southwestern group, but specimens are sometimes brought up from the south in cartons when people move, and a population can get established in a house that those cartons are moved to. They don't spread. They don't survive outdoors over the winter. But you can have a localized introduced population. Again, you're not likely to be bitten. The spiders are not aggressive. In fact, as the recluse name suggests, I mean, they tend to stick in the basements and near the corners, and so you're not likely to be bitten. But the venom of those spiders does have a tissue-destroying effect. It's called a necrotic venom.
Alan from Westchester is on the air. Hi, Alan.
Alan, I'm a great show, a little creepy, but really, really, really terrific.
Creepy, or what about crawly?
A little creepy and crawly. I heard that some of the venom from spiders now is being investigated for some medicinal reasons to possibly treat some neuromuscular diseases. Do you have any information on that?
That's correct. Most spider venoms have no effect at all on vertebrates or people, but there are some that seem to be able to impede the transfer of nerve impulses across synapses. And because there are neurological diseases that specifically involve things going wrong with those kinds of neural transmissions, epilepsy being a case in point, venoms that have those kinds of properties are actively being investigated as potential cures for those diseases.
We have a lot of people writing in. Andrew asks, I've heard that if a spider's web is destroyed, it cannot build it again or cannot do the same kind of web. Is that true?
No, it's not true. Normally, the spider will consume the silk. If it loses the silk entirely, then that's a big hit on its energetics. It takes a lot of energy to spin that much silk and produce a new web, but it can certainly do so.
Steve asks, I've always heard that daddy long-legged spiders actually have venom that would harm humans, but their mouths are too small to bite human skin. Any truth to that?
It's a little difficult because the common names are very imprecise, and that's why scientists don't use them. Daddy long legs most commonly refers here in the U.S. to a different group of arachnids, harvestmen or pileonids, they're called. They're not spiders, and they don't have venom at all. Some people use daddy long legs for a particular kind of spider that's frequently found in basements and cellars that have extremely long legs. Yes, it's very unlikely that those spiders could break your skin.
Corinne in Manhattan asks, why don't we use spider silk? Is it not as good or strong as silkworm silk?
Oh, it is. Material scientists are fascinated by spider silk because it's an incredible material. It has a tensile strength that's greater than steel of the same diameter. And if you think about it, spider silk has to be that strong because when an insect flies into a spider web, it's moving at a very fast speed. The silk has to be able to expand enormously and then contract again without breaking. And there are no man-made fibers that can do that. And if we could synthesize the equivalent of spider silk in those regards, we could revolutionize everything from parachutes to bulletproof vests because spider silk is so strong and yet so lightweight. But spider silk is not easy to harvest like silk moth silk for fabrics. Why? Because you can raise a whole bunch of silk moths in one container. Spiders will eat each other, so you'd have to house them separately and get the silk from them individually, one at a time. And that has been done occasionally throughout history. In fact, the museum recently had on display a piece of silk fabric made in Madagascar entirely from silk produced by the golden silk spider, which is one of the kinds of spiders that's in our exhibition.
Now, Hazel, a listener called in earlier, you heard, said this is kind of creepy. Do people say the exhibit at the museum is creepy?
Not at all. We've had a great response from visitors. Mostly they seem to be very curious. They have a lot of questions. They like to be able to get close to see the spiders. We've had a lot of interest in actually looking at the brown recluse and the black widow for people that have never actually seen them. They want to be able to identify them. We have a lot of other spiders that are interested in the webs that they're building. And they don't seem to be creeped out at all.
We haven't talked about the black widow spiders. They are dangerous, aren't they?
They are. They're one of the few, as Norm mentioned, in the U.S. that are dangerous to humans.
Why would they even bite a human?
Well, they wouldn't. Normally, they wouldn't want to go after a human and bite them. Usually, bites are very accidental. If someone's put their hand where they weren't looking, they've just got it too close, the spider has been cornered, it feels like it has no other response than to bite. So bitings tend to be very accidental.
Lamar from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Why do spiders nest or gather in the attic or in basements, damp basements, in homes?
Well, they're looking for prey, so they're trying to use all their senses as best they can to find the best place to find the maximum number of prey.
Corey from Parsippany, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I heard a weird statistic that humans, on average, per year, eat a certain amount of spiders unintentionally, either in their sleep or in their food or something. Is that true?
No, that's an urban myth.
Okay.
Again, the spiders, the normal reaction of the spider is to get as far away from you as it can.
But wouldn't spiders also be sometimes in, let's say, a bag of nuts or at least parts of spiders? There's often
spiders
parts of insects and all sorts of things like that.
Right. Spiders can get shipped in products. There are large spiders that have the common name banana spiders because they're commonly introduced on bananas from the tropics.
Is there a rock star spider in the exhibit, Hazel?
There seems to be some that are particularly popular. The Mexican red knee that we have, a lot of people really like to see that one. People want to see the Goliath bird eater that we have because it is one of the largest species of spiders. The one that we have on exhibit is not a full-grown adult, so it's not at its maximum size.
And how big will it go?
It could get 12 inches, you know,
wow.
as a really full-grown
That's
female.
Almost a crab.
Right. But ours is, she's about 7 inches leg span.
Which came first, the crabs, the lobsters, or the spiders?
Well, certainly marine arthropods preceded anything that was on land, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we love spiders and crabs, we love lobsters and crabs, or
absolutely.
Some of us do, would spiders be interesting to eat, at least the larger ones?
There are native tribes in the Neotropics that do indeed eat tarantulas because the tarantulas in the New World often have urticating hairs on their abdomen, which are hairs that have barbs on them, much like a wasp sting. And if a tarantula is disturbed, let's say, by a mouse trying to enter its burrow, it can take its hind legs and it'll scratch those legs off of its abdomen and fling them in the direction of the mouse.
Wow.
And if those hairs get in the eyes or nose or mouth of the mouse, it'll irritate the skin. So it's a defense mechanism. And so the people who eat the tarantulas have to scrape those hairs off because you certainly don't want to swallow them.
Peter in Ulster County asks, I've heard that hummingbirds in my yard use spider silk to make their nests. Is that true?
I have heard that. I have not seen it myself, but there are apparently valid records of spider silk being harvested by birds to be to use in nest construction. Yes.
Carol from Teaneck, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Hi. I've always been sensitive to spiders, so I've encouraged my children not to squish them in the house, but to usher them outside. And I wondered if that is disorienting to the spiders, and could we be doing more damage to them?
No, no. As long as you don't physically harm them, they're likely to find more prey outside. I wouldn't necessarily encourage people to do that unless they want larger insect populations inside their house. I mean, the spiders are doing you a good deed in general. But no, ushering them outside safely, there's no problem with that.
And along those lines, Bennett from Brooklyn says, some cultures consider killing spiders bad luck. Where does that story come from?
You don't know. You need an anthropologist for that.
Okay, well, I want to thank the both of you so much for being on our show today for this Please Explain Look at Spiders. My guests have been Dr. Norm Plotnick, the Curator Emeritus in the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Invertebrate Zoology and the Curator of the Museum's new exhibition called Spiders Alive. Hazel Davis is the Associate Director of Living Exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History, and we have a slideshow of spiders from that exhibit on our show page at wnyc.org.